This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A vaccine for smallpox was developed in 1796. It was the first vaccine ever created, and it was a miracle. Vaccines for cholera, rabies, tetanus, typhoid fever, and bubonic plague would follow in the 1800s. The 20th century would see the development of vaccines for diphtheria, tuberculosis, scarlet fever, whooping cough, yellow fever, typhus, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, meningitis, hepatitis, and many others. These were all miracle drugs because in areas where they were put into wide use, they virtually eradicated diseases that used to kill large portions of the population. For parents of children in the 1950s, Jonas Salk's creation of a vaccine for polio in 1952 was a godsend. But today, some parents are rejecting vaccines. They are refusing to have their children vaccinated for fear of their contracting some other condition as a result of being vaccinated. The recent outbreak of measles, the epicenter for which was Disneyland in California, was brought on largely due to the existence of a significant number of unvaccinated children. So how do you weigh the rights of parents to decide about medical treatment for their children against public health? Why this backlash against vaccination? Is receiving a vaccination risky business? And if so, are these vaccinations worth the risk? Karen Garlow and Mitch Weiss have been looking into all of this. Karen is the medical and healthcare reporter for the Charlotte Observer and finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for her series on nonprofit hospitals. She joins us in our studio. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Nice
How
to
have
I'm great. Nice to have you back. We're going to be talking to Mitch Weiss a little bit later on in the program. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and correspondent for the Associated Press. But also joining us from the studios of WABE in Atlanta is Dr. Jeff Engel, Executive Director of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. Prior to holding that position, Dr. Engel was North Carolina State Health Director. Doctor, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
I think we'll start with measles. It's a good place to start, given the recent outbreak. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, prior to the creation of a measles vaccine in the mid-1960s, 3 to 4 million people in this country got the disease every year. 4 to 500 of them died. Since 2000, when because of the vaccine, measles was declared eliminated, only between 337 and 650 people even got the measles in this country. That's a testimony to the efficacy of the vaccine. How many people have suffered debilitation or debilitating conditions or death that they can attribute to the measles vaccine since the 1960s? Does anybody know the answer to that question?
I don't know the answer to that in particular.
Doctor?
I don't have a number for that either, because your description of a devastating or debilitating illness would require somewhat of a large review of the medical literature. I'm just not sure that's ever been compiled.
But would you say it is, I mean, anecdotally, within the medical field, would it be a significant number? Would it be a tiny number? Would it be a number that would raise eyebrows and you would have to start thinking about whether or not you would want to warn parents about giving their children a measles vaccination?
With that framework, the answer to that question is that this would be a very unusual complication. The best evidence we have is on the claims that are submitted to the National Vaccine Compensation Program, and very few of those are adjudicated for injury. So based on that information, that's not from the 1960s, that's when the legislation went into effect in 1988, we can say that it's a very unusual occurrence to have injury from a measles vaccine.
Okay. You say that in the 1950s, the decade before the measles vaccine became available, about one child in 1,000 who got measles died from the disease each year. But that number, but the number of vaccine-related injuries is nowhere near that order of magnitude. So why the pushback against being vaccinated? Do you understand it, Doctor?
Well, there's actually a whole science around vaccine hesitancy. And I think parents have a lot of reasons for concerns. Certainly in the last 10 to 15 years, there was the erroneous reports on increased incidence of autism related to vaccines. And that's been completely discredited and is not credible information at all. But if you really explore parents' hesitancy to vaccinate their children, it's more complicated than fear of autism. It has to do a lot with people actually not experiencing any of these diseases in modern times. So today's parents were immunized when they were children. So we've had two or three generations now who've really never seen the devastating illnesses like polio you mentioned or measles before. So they really don't have a context to understand what the risk of developing the actual disease is.
I'm old enough to remember, although I was just a really young child, I remember my parents not allowing me to go swimming in a public pool in the summertime for fear of polio until the vaccine came out. I remember having the measles. I had the chicken pox, for which there are vaccines today. You've talked, Karen, to a lot of parents, and we'll talk about this in some depth. You wanted to make sure that they were being heard because you felt, in fact, that they were not being heard. They were being marginalized. But when you talked to them, what were their reasons for not wanting to vaccinate their children?
Well, and let me say first that when I wrote this article in early March, that I didn't intend for it to be anti-vaccine at all.
Right.
I was just trying to fill a hole in the coverage that I was reading and hearing. And so it wasn't just about the measles vaccine. It was about vaccines in general that I hear from parents and some doctors who have concerns but were reluctant to, you know, speak publicly sometimes. Some of their concerns stem from having personal experience with seeing their own children respond after, in the hours or days after a set of vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
As I wrote, you hear eerily similar stories from people about 15 to 18-month-old children who had been walking and talking and suddenly stopped walking and talking and develop seizures and fevers and may recover, but some may not. And while those are anecdotal and that can be criticized, you know, if you're just telling a story, I decided to go looking for some examples that had been substantiated. And I know, as Dr. Engel just referred to, there's a vaccine adverse event reporting system and a vaccine court that was created in 1988 by Congress,
which we'll talk about with Mitch Weiss later on.
Right. And so it was easy to find some Charlotte area families who had been through the vaccine court process and had received compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote about one of them that had lived in Mooresville for a good long time. And their daughter, Angelica, had developed seizures after a set of vaccines as a baby and developed encephalopathy, which is brain damage, and which was diagnosed by her local neurologist as vaccine-related, and then later the vaccine court concluded also that it was vaccine related.
How can you tell?
Well, in the case of the vaccine court, there's a table of injuries that was created in the in the regulations following the legislation that connects or lists each vaccine possible side effects and if they occur in a certain time period after the vaccine. It was assumed that it was vaccine-related.
If you get a flu shot, which is a vaccination, you are told that you may experience a little swelling and soreness around the site of the vaccination in the next couple of days. You're told that you may develop a slight fever or chills and flu-like symptoms. You won't get the flu, but you may feel that way. That's obviously the body's reaction to the vaccine. So let's start with some basic science, doctor. What exactly is a vaccine, and how does it work?
Vaccines are biologics, so they're not chemical drugs per se. They are active biologics, and they prevent usually bacterial or viral infections. And what they are prepared virus particles, either killed or live. So in the example of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, those are all live attenuated viruses, meaning that they can't cause the actual disease because they've been genetically manipulated and are weak, but they can stimulate a robust human immune response. So that's exactly what's desired. Versus a hepatitis shot, for A, hepatitis A or B, those are killed vaccines or just particles of those vaccines that stimulate the same kind of immune response.
We're talking about vaccines this morning, and we'll explore a lot of different factors about these things, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the vaccine court that I didn't know until yesterday existed as we go through the program here on Charlotte Talks this morning on WFAE. But when you get a vaccination and you're using this live attenuated virus, or you're using a virus that has been killed, what's happening here is that your immune system is kicking into high gear. It recognizes it as a foreign body, and it goes after it. And that immune system reaction can cause you to feel bad, or can cause you to have some symptoms that maybe would be associated with the virus you've been given in the vaccine, correct?
That's absolutely correct. So I think looking at the smallpox vaccine, which we don't use anymore because the disease has been eradicated from the world population, that caused a viral infection, actually. When you inoculate it in your arm, you would get a series of pustules that would resolve over a couple of weeks. But those pustules were active vaccinia virus infection, which is a form of the attenuated smallpox virus.
So could the body's reaction in some cases be so severe that is that what's happening in these young people who have these reactions that lead to brain damage, etc.? Is that what's happening? Their body has reacted so violently to the virus that it's overcompensated?
That's presumably one of the mechanisms, and certainly it makes a lot of sense because the brain is full of immune cells, and so it wouldn't be unreasonable to suspect that this immune response is happening in the brain in some sort of abnormal way, albeit rare, that stimulates a response that's unwanted in the central nervous system.
Except for the principal ingredient, which would change, obviously, depending upon whether you're being vaccinated for smallpox or measles or rubella, are all vaccines pretty much the same, and do they all work in pretty much the same way?
Yes, I think they're largely divided into killed or live products. And of the killed, they're all now subparticles and newer technologies using cloning and DNA techniques and so on. But by and large, they all work the same way.
Has this become a topic of conversation within the medical community, particularly among epidemiologists, these pockets, and we'll talk about them later on, these pockets of resistance around the country in the Midwest, along the coast, where there are people who simply will not allow their children to be vaccinated? Has this become a topic of conversation?
Yeah, very much so. And so there's a whole field developing in epidemiology now called vaccine hesitancy and trying to understand why these pockets of populations of people are refusing. But on the other hand, public health officials are very busy enforcing their regulations in these unimmunized populations. So, for example, during an outbreak, these children who are unimmunized can actually be excluded from school. And that's a lot of work for public health to enforce all those regulations around lack of vaccine.
I want to come back to that when we come back from the break, because it's fascinating to me that parents not only can refuse the vaccine, but they can also put their children in a school setting, even though they have not gotten the required vaccinations. We'll take that up in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about vaccinations today and vaccines and how they work and why some people see them as dangerous and will not allow their children to be vaccinated. Perhaps you have been affected by the news about side effects from vaccines, and it's made you think twice about vaccinating your child. If so, how did you make your decision about vaccinations? Let us know. Email us at charlottetalks at wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're here with Karen Garlow, who's a medical and healthcare reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Dr. Jeff Engel, executive director of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. There are pockets of people around the country, particularly in the upper Midwest for some reason, along the coasts, that have been reluctant to having their child vaccinated, and yet their children go to school. How is that possible?
Well, every state is different in their laws and their exclusion principles, but most states do have vaccine laws and rules in effect, and the enforcement of them is what can be variable. So first of all, children have to be screened when they enter school, and this is often not that straightforward, although immunization registries are by and large available in every state. And depending on the laws of that state, a child must have vaccines in certain states, such as North Carolina. But in other states, there are all sorts of exclusions that are allowed other than for bona fide religious purposes. So just personal preference is one reason, or personal belief is one reason to not have a vaccine. And in those states, children are allowed to attend school.
Does that, and given the personal exemptions and the rising number, evidently, of people who really don't want their children to be vaccinated, as a public health person, does that alarm you?
Yes, it's alarming because nothing is worse for spread than school-aged children in an enclosed environment like school.
But if you're a child who has been vaccinated, you've gotten your series of shots at the system, the school system, and the state says you have to have to attend school, and you're in a classroom with a child who has not received any of those, are you in any danger because you've been vaccinated? Are you immune to whatever they might bring to the classroom?
The children who have been immunized, yes, are immune. So those kids themselves are not at risk. Of course, it's just the broader population that we're concerned about. So oftentimes it's not just one child in that classroom. Mm-hmm. It may be several, and then they bring it into the community.
But the community at large, it seems to me, after all these years, because the 20th century was the century of vaccines, the community at large must be relatively immune. Either they got the measles vaccine or they got the measles and they can't get it again. So is alarm the right word to use? In other words, how dangerous is it to have these children not vaccinated? How bad could an outbreak be given what we just talked about?
Right. So I think what we're describing here is the concept of herd immunity. And herd immunity is when enough people are immunized in a population, either through natural infection or vaccine, that it's actually protective of spread in the greater community, just because everyone has, or most people have, immunity. The problem is it's dangerous to experiment with that herd immunity threshold. So is it 95%, or when we go down to 90%, or when is that threshold reached when we could have a serious outbreak on our hands? And with the current measles situation, I think we're seeing what can happen, that it can be spread person to person to person in the community for quite an extended time. Now, we're not going to experience any huge widespread outbreak in measles with the current situation because of herd immunity, but you know, the more we put our guard down, the more potential there is to reach that threshold when there won't be enough herd immunity in the community.
North Carolina, I'm told, ranks slightly ahead of the rest of the nation in terms of participation in vaccinations. In 2013, 72% of North Carolina children 19 to 35 months received immunizations, compared to 70% nationally. Nearly 99% of this state's children received the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine before kindergarten. Do we know if any problems arose with children, or if we have a higher percentage of problems from vaccinations because we have a higher percentage of participation in vaccinations in North Carolina? Do we know?
I don't think we have a large problem in North Carolina because of that high participation rate. And for measles in particular, we didn't have any cases of measles this year, and we had one in 2014. There is a high participation rate for vaccination in North Carolina, and that is a good thing. It is a good public health measure to be vaccinated. One of the reasons that I decided to focus on the vaccine court story and highlight a person who had been injured was because, unlike Dr. Engel's measured responses to you, some of the coverage that I had noticed early on was very absolute about, you know, vaccines are safe. You know, there's a group of so-called highly intelligent or educated people who are choosing sort of stupidly not to take advantage of this, and in a selfish way and risking the lives of others.
That's how they were being portrayed.
That's how they were being portrayed, I thought. In fact, any time that someone, a politician or whoever, stepped forward to suggest that there might be some problem with vaccine, they were shouted down, I felt. And so I felt like it was important to give that that side of it at least a little bit of an airing, because those are true stories, even if they are rare, and they deserve some discussion
But those stories gain traction because parents are concerned rightfully about their children, and they hear about somebody else's child who has suffered horrible damage allegedly as a result of these vaccinations, and they're bound and determined not to let their children suffer the same thing, so they forego the vaccinations. When did this start to become a noticeable trend? Was it simply that article that appeared, I think, in the British medical publication The Lancet by Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who was completely discredited? He had connected vaccinations to autism. He later retracted that. He was discredited. He lost his license to practice medicine as a result of this. But stories like that also tend to stick around. Is there a connection, a big connection there, or are there other things at play here?
Well, that was discredited, and that particular research is not valid. However, the reason that the vaccine court was created in 1988 was because there were cases of parents claiming their children were damaged by the pertussis vaccine, which were winning jury verdicts against pharmaceutical companies, and that's why the vaccine court was created.
Is there a connection, doctor, between being vaccinated and autism?
No, there is no evidence of that.
No evidence whatsoever anywhere.
That's correct.
What kinds of, Karen mentioned encephalopathy, which is brain damage. There is a connection between, or is there a connection between vaccinations and that?
Yes, there is. And she mentioned the pertussis, and that's why they actually changed the formulation of the pertussis vaccine and to take away some of those side effects of mainly febrile seizures in young children. And that's what's in the current DTP shot, is that attenuated or that altered pertussis component. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's not as efficacious, and we're finding out now that we're having a lot of outbreaks of whooping cough in the United States because the new product is not as efficacious as the old. It's safer, but not as effective.
And you've written, Karen, that the National Vaccine Information Center, something I didn't know existed until yesterday, does not focus on autism. It instead focuses on encephalopathy or brain damage, which they say has been associated with vaccines since the very first vaccine was used. How common is it, however, to have that kind of damage in the aftermath?
I can't tell you exactly how common. What I know only is that In the vaccine court, about 4,000 cases of claims. This is not all encephalopathy by any means, but 4,000 claims have been adjudicated and confirmed, and for a payout of $2.8 billion. One of the things I would say is that what people will say, and what that one organization that you just mentioned is suggesting, is that instead of focusing on autism, maybe it's other things, and that there's this combination of having a pre-existing condition of some type a propensity for something, and then getting the vaccine, and that if you have a genetic condition or a mitochondrial condition, metabolic disorder, that some things go wrong, and that one of the local neurologists I spoke to said, you know, he'd just seen a child whose cousin had a similar reaction. They both had some kind of reaction to the vaccine, and in that case, the neurologist said a parent might have a reason for being cautious and perhaps stretching out the vaccine schedule instead of having so many at once, because even the Institute of Medicine has said that that not enough study has been done on the cumulative effect of so many vaccines.
So, Doctor, aside from encephalopathy, which I believe you would say can be caused by vaccination, what other conditions does the medical community believe could be caused by vaccination?
I think the other most common one would be a severe allergic reaction to either the vaccine itself or a component of the vaccine.
With lasting, lingering effects, or just...
Right. Well, some of them can be fatal. I mean, it's called an anaphylactic shock reaction.
Okay.
These are extremely uncommon. But yes, they can be either fatal or long-lasting in their...
Would it be accurate to say, that vaccines are safe, but that in a small subset of children with certain genetic markers or other pre-existing problems that we could or could not know about, that they may cause problems? And is there any way to test for those problems in advance?
Well, that is safe to say, that nothing in this world or universe, particularly in the medical environment, is 100% safe. But as Karen alluded to, with only 4,000 adjudications, you got to look at the denominator there. In that time period, there's been over 90 million children immunized. So, you know, do the math on how rare this is. And if you count adult immunizations, it's even more uncommon. So, you know, when you're consulting at the bedside and you're talking about risk and safety, the side towards efficacy on these vaccines is so, so much in favor of giving the shot that, you know, the concept of first do no harm really doesn't come into play when you're at the bedside and offering these immunizations
to
families.
But do we know why, after the fact, do we know why certain children seem to be negatively affected or impacted by these vaccines? And could that be something that we test for in advance, predict, and maybe change the way we do it for that individual?
Yeah, I think that's coming. Certainly with the advent of modern genetics and everyone having their own genome sequenced, I think we're going to be learning more and more about that. But current technology, if you look at the population at large, there are really no tests available to predict who will have these severe reactions to immunizations. And again, if you're looking at it, such a rare event, a screening test in a general population would not be really the way to go. We would need something more advanced than that. And I don't think that's that far off, again, particularly with modern genetics and being able to understand people's complete gene sequence so readily. So maybe in the near future.
Okay. Under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, $3 billion has been awarded to children and adults for whom the risks of vaccine injury were 100%. That's from the National Vaccine Information Center. What does that mean, near 100%? That they absolutely could attribute the medical problem to having been vaccinated? Is that what that means?
I'll let Karen weigh in on that, but it's the federal court that determines this, but they look at all the available medical evidence, certainly.
Karen, weigh in on
it. And it's their best judgment that that was the case, that it was caused by the vaccine, yes.
Okay. We're talking about vaccinations here and their medical complications that may or may not result from them on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. Karen, you want to weigh in on that?
As I started to say earlier, there's a table of injuries that that is in the law that specifies that if certain side effects shows up in a certain period after a vaccine, that and initially they just assumed, you know, per se, you had a vaccine injury. Mm-hmm. It's become more adversarial in recent years, where lawyers for both sides bring in expert witnesses and present evidence like you would in a civil, more like a civil trial. And so, you know, if some of these 4,000 petitioners have received money, it means that the court concluded that their injuries were vaccine-related.
But there are problems with the vaccine courts, and we'll talk about those with Mitch Weiss in just a few minutes here, because there are significant problems with that court, evidently. So there are risks, undeniable risks, although they may be small and they may be highly individualized, there are risks to having your child vaccinated. Those risks, then, have always been there. And the 20th century, as I said a second ago, was the century of vaccines. All these new vaccines came online and virtually eradicated a lot of devastating childhood diseases. Why, then, are the misgivings and the complaints and the lawsuits and the injuries that we're seeing in some cases, why are they just now coming to light?
Well, I don't think they are just now coming to light, actually. I've written about this in years past. Maybe it's more widespread because of social media, you know, people talking to each other more easily, connecting on particular subject. I do want to say that, you know, vaccines are a good thing, and we don't, as Dr. Engel said, we don't maybe remember the horrors, you know, that were evident when these childhood illnesses were more prevalent in our lives. Whereas now, you know, the things we see are, some parents are seeing autism. You know, it is not that autism is connected to vaccines now, but that's a thing that's on the rise too.
Karen Garlow is a reporter, medical reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're also talking to Dr. Jeff Engel, Executive Director of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. When we come back, we'll be joined by an AP reporter, Mitch Weiss, to talk about the vaccine courts that have been in existence for a while. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about vaccinations and vaccines, and are they safe? And there are, in fact, as we've come to discover, risks involved, but the risks are relatively low but unpredictable. Dr. Jeff Engel is with us, Executive Director of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists and the former State Health Director here in North Carolina. Karen Garlow is a medical healthcare reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And we're going to be joined now by Mitch Weiss. Mitch is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and a correspondent for the Associated Press, who's done a whole series on the vaccine courts. Thank you for joining us, Mitch.
It's good to be here, Mike. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. There is this vaccine court. Again, I didn't know anything about this until yesterday. It's well hidden. It came into being in 1988 to protect the pharmaceutical companies from liability. And the reason they wanted to do that, Mitch, was because what? They didn't want them to stop producing vaccines, correct?
Correct. In about the mid-1980s, vaccine makers went to Congress and they said, look, we're getting sued by parents who claim that DPT and other vaccines are causing injuries. And if the vaccine makers said, if we didn't get some kind of legislation, we were just going to pull out of the market. Well, the government was concerned about that, because at the time, vaccines really weren't moneymakers for the pharmaceuticals like they are today. And essentially what happened was they decided, we're going to set up this special court, and we're going to shield the pharmaceutical companies from liability. And in effect, the federal government would become the defendant in these cases. And because we're doing that, what we're also going to do is we're going to make these cases heard more like Social Security cases. They're going to go before a judge, and you know, both sides will come up, talk to the judge, give their case, and a judge will make a ruling, and everything had to be done within 240 days. And that was, in theory, where that was supposed to happen. So the pharmaceutical companies, you know, are shielded from liability, and now every case involving a vaccine injury, doesn't matter where you are in the country, has to be filed in this court in Washington, D.C. But essentially what's happened over the years is that the cases have become so contentious that, you know, this whole system is broken. And we were the first news organization, and it took us a while to FOIA and create a database of every case ever filed in vaccine court. And there have been 14,000. And so we were able to look at some of the trends. So, for example, we found that, you mentioned that $3 billion figure that's been paid out earlier. But in one-third of those cases, the government actually fought those claims and made it incredibly difficult for families to be compensated. And we found that under the law, it says it's supposed to take 240 days with an additional 150 days for the entire claim to be resolved. And we found that the average, and we took out autism because autism was kind of, you know, it increased the time. And but if you just took out all the autism cases, which were filed once, it took close to, you know, 3.5 years for these claims to actually be adjudicated. And we found more than 600 cases that took more than a decade.
I want to talk about the length of time here, but let's back up for just a couple of seconds.
Sure.
Doesn't the mere existence of a vaccine court speak volumes about the risks involved in having your child vaccinated? Does it not make people believe even more fervently that vaccines are dangerous?
Well, here's the problem. Yes, indeed, all the claims that are paid out are because of vaccine injuries, and I want to go back to one other thing. It used to be that most of the injuries involved children, and now most of the claims filed in vaccine court involve adults, mostly, you know, flu shot and GPS, you know, related claims. But yes, all the claims that are paid out, it's because a vaccine caused an injury. What's unclear, you know, doctors will say it's extremely rare that somebody is injured by a vaccine. But, you know, there haven't been any, you know, studies that say, okay, is it one in a billion, one in a trillion? And under the law that was set up in 1986 and went into effect in 1988, the government was supposed to study that very issue as well as promote the program. And what we found in our investigation is that they haven't done any studies. And in fact, they haven't done anything to even promote the fact that there is a program in case your child or, you know, your loved one is injured by a vaccine. In fact, we found that they spent $320,000 2 years ago, the last time we had the statistics updated. And most of that money, you know, to promote the program, but most of that money went to doctors in the program who went to medical conventions to recruit doctors, you know, review, you know, the claim. And so it's every part of the system is broken, from the government that's fighting legitimate claims to actually the lawyers who are filing claims that sometimes aren't, you know, they're filing them without medical documentation, some of the basic things that you need for these claims to move forward.
So Dr. Engel, he mentioned that there were 14,000 cases settled. I don't know how much you know about the particulars of the vaccine court. But when the government decides, or the judge in those courts decide that a problem was caused by a vaccination, are you convinced that the judge has decided it based on true medical evidence, or are you still uncertain about that? Maybe it's just a way to sweep this under the rug and keep it quiet with a little money.
Well, this is the rough edge, I think, between anything and science that comes before a court, is looking at the facts as they're presented by both cases. And as Mitch said, it's a very adversarial environment where a lot of emotion involved, too. So I think a judge does his or her best to look at the facts as presented and make a decision. Now, these tort-like cases are really based on a preponderance of evidence. It's not a criminal standard of a smoking gun, per se. So they look at the preponderance of evidence and make the best decision they can.
Because, Mitch, you report, you and the AP, the Associated Press, discovered that there is a financial incentive for lawyers to file claims, because just to file, not to win, just to file, because these lawyers are compensated by the government. So as a result, they overfile claims. Talk about that.
Right. And that's what I meant earlier, that all the sides involved in the court, I mean, it's broken, you know, from the government to the lawyers. The lawyer, usually with a liability lawyer, they get paid when they win a case. And usually that payout is a third of the award at the end. So there, you know, most lawyers are looking for that big payout, that multi-million dollar payout. Mm-hmm. But they're not going to get that in vaccine court. essentially, what happens is they get paid whether they win or lose. And so for them to make money, they have to turn cases sometimes. And what we found is, for example, there were several times when, like when the hepatitis B vaccine was added to the table, and there was a 3-month period where you could file all the old cases before that were grandfathered in. We found that, you know, some of the lawyers were filing hundreds and hundreds of these, you know, Hep B cases back in the late 90s, and some of them are still being adjudicated to this day. But they're getting paid for each one as long as it was filed in good faith, and that's key. But we found that even when cases were filed without medical documentation, even when they were filed when there was no evidence that maybe the person didn't get vaccinated, they were still being paid. It was very rare when a judge did not pay a vaccine lawyer. And they were also getting paid, you know, for taking expensive trips outside the country, you know, looking for experts, when in fact, you know, if you look at their bills, they were staying at 5-star hotels in Switzerland and all over Europe. And so there were abuses on that part. But on the other hand, again, it goes back to the government as well. There were times that the government fought these cases tooth and nail, even though they knew that there was enough evidence there that this person was probably injured by a vaccine.
You discovered another problem as well, and that is that most of the doctors hired by the government in this court to defend vaccine safety have ties to the pharmaceutical industry, while so-called experts testifying against vaccine were kind of specious as well. You say that some of the most prominent experts set up nonprofits questioning vaccine safety, which I guess that fuels public skepticism, but does it also line these experts' pockets? This whole thing seems ill thought out.
Right. Well. Essentially, what happens is once a claim is filed, it goes to a group of doctors who are hired by the government, and they actually review the merits of the case, and then they make a recommendation, and that's either compensate or concede. But the final decision on that goes then to the Department of Justice, which, by the way, is funded from that $3 billion trust fund, which comes from, you know, the 75-cent tax on each vaccine. And their inclination is we're going to fight all the claims. Even when the government, you know, the doctors say concede, they usually fight, in part because it's about policy. The government is so afraid that if they compensate too many cases, it's going to send the wrong message that indeed vaccines are, you know, unsafe, and then it's going to reduce the vaccination rates. And of course, you guys probably talked about this earlier, you know, it all depends on herd immunity. Essentially, we need everybody to be vaccinated for the vaccinations to truly be effective.
I'm wondering about the validity of this court, because you say they were designed to favor payout, but the government doesn't really publicize the courts because they fear it will lead to the public skipping inoculations. So do these courts work, or do they simply waste taxpayer money? Are they needed, or would a regular court suffice?
Well, I think that the reason it was set up in part was to avoid contentious litigation. And in fact, it's become even more contentious than if it were in, you know, civil court. I think the concept could work. And, you know, there are people who've gotten money. Again, they've paid out $3 billion. But again, a third of that people had to fight for. And even when, you know, the payments were approved, it still took years for the government to actually pay out the claims to families.
Is that why you say that this program, instead of helping families, has heaped additional suffering on them?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. What we found, and this is the amazing part, because we were the only news organization to have the 14,000 cases, and, you know, we did queries and we read the cases and interviewed dozens and dozens and dozens of victims, families who went to this court in good faith. And essentially, what it comes down to is you could have two victims who were injured by the same vaccine under the similar circumstances, and it all depends on which special master you go to, whether or not you're going to be compensated. And there's no precedent of law, so each case is new. Every time it goes before a judge, they don't look at earlier cases. It's treated as a brand new case. And so that's, and then as you read the, you know, the rulings from the judges, we found that there were some judges who dislike, you know, the attorneys and some of the experts they use, and rarely, if ever, compensate. Then there are others who are just on the opposite side. So if you're injured, if you have a loved one, a child injured, or a family member who went down to the corner drugstore and got that flu shot and they're injured, it's all going to depend on which special master it goes before, whether or not you're going to be compensated. And that's what we found. Sometimes there's no rhyme or reason who gets compensated and who doesn't.
We're talking about the very complicated world of vaccines and vaccination today on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. I don't know how many cases this vaccine court takes every year or how many are settled, but Mitch, you say that many of those who received the $2.8 billion that the government says it distributed through March of 2014 would not have won in a civil trial. So are they just being given money to keep them quiet, to placate them?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are people who are legitimately injured by vaccines who, you know, deserve to get the money. I mean, that's why the system was set up. They were promised by the government that this is what's going to happen. We're going to shield the pharmaceutical companies who are threatening to leave. Hmm. You know, we're going to, you know, shield them from, you know, any liability. You cannot sue a pharmaceutical company over an injury related to a vaccine. But in return, we're going to set up this court that's going to make it easier for victims, okay, people who are injured, to be compensated. That was the deal. That was the law. And essentially, it hasn't happened because people have to fight, I mean, tooth and nail. Even when the government eventually concedes, they still have to fight to even get money after that. Hmm. So the promise to the people, to the victims, really hasn't been fulfilled. Plus, there have been 14,000 cases, but I would ask anybody who's listening today, the next time you go to a doctor and you have your child with you and they're going to be vaccinated, see if they mention, you know, vaccine court. When you go down to the corner drugstore to get that flu shot, just ask them. But first, listen. See if they mention vaccine court. Oh, you know, there is a reaction. You're injured. Here's a special place. I would venture to say in most cases that's not going to happen.
Doctor,
in part, you know, because they don't want the word to get out about this court.
What I'd like to add to, okay, Mike. I just feel like if there was a more open conversation about all of this, there might be less fear, you know,
right,
instead of trying to shut everybody up.
Dr. Engel, I have 15 seconds. Are you concerned that perhaps one of the problems is we give too many of these shots at the same time?
Well, again, there's no evidence of that, including attenuating the schedule, lessen the amount. There's no evidence that it matters.
No evidence, or we simply don't know?
Well, I would say no evidence.
Okay. Dr. Jeff Engel, Executive Director of the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, Karen Garlow, Medical and Health Reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Mitch Weiss, a correspondent and investigative reporter for Associated Press. Thank you all for the hour.